Yes, our duty of opposition. In other words, fight back. We need to fight back all together as one. I would love to hear you and see you express the importance of this. If you love being gay as much as I do, fight back.
Larry Kramer, dead at the age of 84, will post the whole speech online. I'm Amy Goodman. Stay safe.
Listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming online at kboo.fm.
This is Erin Yankee, longtime programmer here at KBOO. On March 16th, due to the COVID-19 crisis, KBOO canceled all classes, meetings, and events, and closed the station to all volunteers and staff. We also canceled our spring membership drive. However, a generous, anonymous donor agreed to match every dollar listeners contribute up to $20,000 by May 31st. If you're financially able at this time, we hope you'll contribute to KBOO now at kboo.fm/give. You can also mail your donation to KBOO at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, 97214. The station is working hard to ensure the health and safety of our volunteers, staff, and community, and to provide the volunteer support needed during this time of physical distancing to ensure our eclectic, high-quality programming remains on air and online. Thank you for your support in making this happen. We really appreciate it.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, contact tracing is key to a safe reopening, but hard to put in practice. The source of a mysterious outbreak in the Tri-County metro area is identified, and saving the salmon in Klamath Falls from drought and a court ruling. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, May 28th, 2020. I'm Althea Billings. Just as Multnomah County looks at submitting a plan to the governor for reopening, the Oregon Health Authority is reporting a local outbreak of COVID-19. This afternoon, OHA confirmed it's partnering with multiple agencies to investigate the outbreaks at two Townsend Farm sites. The outbreaks impact Townsend Farms operations in both Multnomah and Washington counties. Townsend Farms is a large fruit growing and processing company. The state health department says it is working to support seasonal workers who have fallen ill and protect others exposed to the virus. They say the outbreak currently affects 48 out of 350 people who arrived in the Portland metro area last week to harvest fruit from Townsend-owned sites in Fairview and Cornelius. Wednesday saw a spike of 41 new cases of the novel coronavirus in Multnomah County alone, This appears to be round two of COVID-19 troubles for the company, as complaints were filed on May 12th with the Oregon Occupational Safety and Health Administration, or OSHA, citing lack of distancing and sanitation measures. Complaints to OSHA allege that COVID-infected workers were back on the job side-by-side other employees after a matter of days. Townsend Farms employs a predominantly Latinx workforce, continuing to work in close quarters, with Multnomah County preparing to submit a reopening plan to Governor Kate Brown with a goal of beginning Stage 1 reopening on June 12th. It remains unclear as to whether this outbreak will push that date back. Washington County gets the green light from the governor to start reopening, but with lots of restrictions. Oregon and Washington continue to have more cases and deaths from the coronavirus, and American deaths and job losses reach new bleak milestones. For those stories and more, here's KBOO's Annette Newell with today's COVID-19 update.
Oregon Governor Kate Brown has announced today that Washington County will begin its gradual reopening on Monday, June 1st. She has granted approval for Washington to enter phase one of her plan for reopening the state. That means that restaurants and bars can open for sit-down service, with requirements of 6 feet of social distancing, a limit to parties of 10 or fewer. Food and drink consumption must end by 10 p.m. and workers have to wear face masks. Barber salons and massage businesses can reopen with social distancing by appointment only and using personal protective equipment. Gyms and fitness centers can also reopen with a maximum gathering limit, social distancing, and sanitation. Washington County has to remain in phase one for at least 3 weeks before it can become eligible for phase two. 31 Oregon counties entered phase one on May 15th. None of them have been approved yet to move on to phase two. To join the rest of the state, Washington and Multnomah counties have been trying to hire dozens of people to work as contact tracers. Though they've had lots of applicants, finding ones with the right skill set is a challenge. The workers help keep outbreaks from growing, finding out who a COVID-19 infected person has been near, connecting sick people to support, and helping those exposed to get tested. Multnomah County Chairwoman Deborah Cafori says a crucial need is to find contact tracers who are fluent in languages other than English, since many in the county speak other languages at home and the contact tracers have to be people they can trust. Washington County's goal is to hire and train 32 contact tracers by Monday. Multnomah County is hiring 122 contact tracers. Today, the Oregon Health Authority reported 49 new cases of COVID-19 and 3 new deaths. This brings the state's total to 4,086 people infected with the virus, which is linked to 151 deaths in Oregon. Washington State's cases have grown to almost 20,000 and more than 1,000 deaths. And the national death toll has surpassed any other country in the world, with 101,217 American lives taken and 1.7 million Americans infected. And today, the country passed another bleak milestone as jobless claims passed the 40 million mark since the coronavirus pandemic took hold. The U.S. Labor Department reported a new surge of layoffs today, with more than 2 million more American workers since last week filing for unemployment. For the KBOO Evening News, I'm Annette Newell.
Multnomah County leaders and health officials announced Wednesday they're planning to begin phase one of reopening after the COVID-19 closure. County Chair Deborah Cafori said the county is aiming to apply on June 5th. If approved by the governor, the county could begin reopening some businesses, including gyms, salons, restaurants, and bars on June 12th. Cafori said the county needs to have the right measures in place before lifting restrictions and said, quote, "Our public health and management teams have been working nonstop to make sure these measures are in place so that we're ready to monitor and closely respond to what happens when we do reopen." Multnomah County has the largest population in the state, with just over 1,000 confirmed cases of COVID-19. On Wednesday, the House Business and Labor Committee summoned Employment Department Director Kay Erickson and top aide David Gerstenfield to a Zoom hearing to speak about why many unemployed Oregonians have not yet received their benefits. KBOO's Melissa Hood has the story.
Oregon's Employment Department claimed they have responded to more than 90% of applications, but because over 400,000 Oregonians have filed for unemployment, there are still tens of thousands without jobs or benefits. According to reporters, Erickson and Gerstenfield took turns reading a 45-page PowerPoint presentation that took up the entire hour the committee's chairman, State Representative Paul Holvey, had allotted for their presentation. Erickson explained that the agency was unprepared for the surge in claims due to COVID-19, which is partly inhibited by the agency's outdated technology. She apologized and spoke about a new plan to clear out the backlog of claims called Project Focus 100. The project aims to process the 38,000 claims backlog as soon as possible, continue hiring more employees, and increase communication with people who have the oldest or most complex claims. Erickson said that about 200 of the agency's 600 employees are teleworking, but expanding beyond their system would overwhelm IT support staff. Chairman Holvey never asked Erickson any questions during the presentation and did not allow other members of the committee to ask questions, saying he would collect their questions and get responses another day. He explained in a statement that, quote, "It was important for the legislature to listen to the agency explain the process so we could follow up with informed questions and work together for solutions instead of just complaining. I'm unsatisfied with what we heard in the committee and the current response, which is why I asked the speaker to provide us an additional opportunity for the agency to answer the committee's questions." For KBOO Evening News, I'm Melissa Hood.
The National Wildlife Federation is pushing for a 21st century civilian conservation corps to create desperately needed jobs and support rural economies in the fallout of the COVID-19 public health crisis. Oregon Senator Ron Wyden has introduced the 21st Century Conservation Corps for Our Health and Jobs Act. In a press conference, he explained the need for the legislation to invest in job training and create jobs to restore public lands and watersheds. Let's listen.
All of us are focused on these job numbers. I mean, rural America feels like it has been hit with a wrecking ball. And as the ranking Democrat on the Finance Committee, I put together the unemployment package. And obviously, those $600 per week extra and covering the additional people is helpful. But there is a lot more that has to be done given the hurt in rural America. We've got so many rural industries just, as I say, taking this extraordinary wallop. You got forestry workers, despite their essential work being laid off. You see that in our papers constantly. And in the West, the recreation industry increasingly is a very powerful economic engine. It is in rural Oregon. It's all it's critically important throughout the West, and it's pretty much come to a complete halt. And my concern is we have to move. You know, getting better doesn't just happen by osmosis. And a 21st century civilian conservation corps is, in my view, one of the key tools that would really be valuable to rural communities. Now it's a must for the economy, a must for public health, and a must for protecting the places that that Americans treasure. That's what my legislation is all about, and making sure that rural America just doesn't get short shrift and, you know, left behind as the country deals with the crisis. What the bill does is it creates a new program of the Department of Labor, really built on most of the core principles and values of the Civilian Conservation Corps from FDR's New Deal, to train and develop and place workers in the outdoor economy. It focuses on trying to get additional help to programs that have proven track records of actually working on the ground, employing workers in rural America, and especially in the woods. And right now, the economists are saying they agree. Headquarters Economics, located in Montana, for example, they say, this is their quote, "These proposed investments will generate jobs immediately." And that's what we want to do. This legislation is about creating jobs, about giving us, giving our people the chance to be healthy. And it focuses on a proposition that's sort of become a kind of watchword in the West, and that is smartly managed forests and clean water and clean air. They're really the backbone of many rural communities. Just a couple of other comments, and I'm going to turn it over to our guests. I'm especially pleased that the concept is really gaining steam and picking up lots of interest. After I introduced my legislation, 80 House Democrats called for a 21st century civilian conservation corps. That is a substantial fraction of the House, and to have them basically shortly after we laid out what this was all about, that 80 members come out strongly for it, means that there's growing awareness that this kind of job creation, especially for young people, and the opportunity it brings to restore lands and boost the outdoor economy and help to make rural America more resilient is key. The last point I want to mention is the fire season, because we've got this global pandemic colliding directly in the middle of a wildfire season, and in our part of the world, it looks like it's going to be a tough one, and having a pandemic intersect with a wildfire, a challenging wildfire season, is a prescription for trouble. I organized a letter that I think many of you have seen to the Forest Service, because you've got the Western senators particularly concerned about what the Forest Service plans are for dealing with fires in a pandemic. Obviously, the Forest Service and Vicki Christensen are looking at a fresh strategy, which is good. But we've got, you know, a lot of questions, and particularly how the agency is going to deal with these fire protocols on the ground, particularly with respect to safety. We asked specifically what measures and training protocols is the agency pursuing to deal with mitigating virus exposure and making sure it's not transmitted during the wildfire season. We sent that letter to the Forest Service. We've not gotten a response, and it's one of the reasons that our legislation is so important, because a combination of getting the Forest Service to do everything they can to make sure that on things like practicing distancing, appropriate distancing, and the like, making sure that that's done, as we do everything we can through our legislation to prevent wildfire smoke that's dangerous to the air and lungs, and particularly vulnerable people, older people in rural America, is important. So, for example, to boost that along, we make sure a priority in our legislation is tackling the maintenance backlog at public recreation facilities on Forest Service, BLM, and parkland.
That was Oregon U.S. Senator Ron Wyden. A dry year and a court decision are disappointing Oregon salmon advocates. Low levels in the Klamath River could make conditions ripe for spreading disease among juvenile salmon. Eric Tegadoff has more on the story.
With the Klamath Basin expected to see one of the driest years on record, struggles for salmon in southern Oregon are piling up this year. The Yurok Tribe and commercial fishing groups tried to convince a federal court that an emergency motion to increase flow in the river was necessary for the fish species. Judge William Orrick of the U.S. District Court for the Northern District of California denied that motion last week. Vice Chairman of the Yurok Tribe, Frankie Myers, says ocean conditions already are bad for the salmon.
They are adapted to handle stressors, but when you compound those stressors, when you have bad flows or poor flows in the spring, plus poor ocean conditions, and then poor conditions in the fall when they come back, it really sets kind of an extinction level event up for salmon.
The Yurok Tribe and environmental groups say a heavier flow is needed to flush out disease among juvenile salmon, which increases in May and June. Oryx's decision is a win for water users such as farmers in the region, who rely on irrigation from the Klamath, and the Klamath tribes, who sided with the water users because the low levels of Upper Klamath Lake are threatening endangered suckerfish. Local water users are planning a rally on Friday. Earth Justice Managing Attorney Patty Goldman says the river needs to be managed for everyone's interest, including the Yurok Tribe and commercial fishermen who have seen salmon numbers plummet.
The suffering that you hear from the farmers is shared by the people who depend on fish for their lives. And so you hear one, but it's important to realize that everyone's hurting and we need to figure out a path forward.
The Klamath River once was the third most productive river for salmon in the continental U.S. Meyer says the increasingly dire ecology of the river means all of the stakeholders need to be at the table when it comes to decision-making.
We have to have some really deep conversations about what the future of the Klamath looks like and the future of allocation, of irrigation, and the tribes being able to continue our way of life.
For Oregon News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for two special rebroadcasts of KBOO News In Depth, covering the CDC downgrade of PPE requirements and protecting nursing home residents from the COVID-19 pandemic. At 6, it's Rose City Native Radio. At 7, it's the Indigenous Power Hour. Then at 8, Soul to Soul. Tonight's weather is partly cloudy with a low of 60. Tomorrow's weather will be partly sunny with a high of 87. Today in history, on this date in 1830, American President Andrew Jackson signed the Indian Removal Act, which denied Native Americans their land rights and forcibly relocated them. The quote of the day is from Choctaw Chief George W. Harkins, who said, quote, "We as Choctaws rather chose to suffer and be free than live under the degrading influence of laws which our voice could not be heard in their formation." Social media companies like Twitter, Facebook, and Google could become liable for the way they police content thanks to an executive order President Trump signed today. The order would open the door for federal regulators to punish social media companies for regulating content, ranging from suspending accounts to deleting posts. According to Trump, the order is intended to push back on political bias in the nation's largest social media platforms. The order comes just days after Twitter added a fact-checking link on some of Trump's tweets that said mail-in voting would be corrupt and unreliable. Trump called this a form of censorship. The executive order targets a 1996 law called the Communications Decency Act. Section 230 of that act gives online platforms a lot of leeway when it comes to what content they allow and how they moderate it. Generally, under this law, tech companies and online platforms are given free rein so long as they are acting in good faith. The directive given by the president would ask the Federal Communications Commission, or the FCC, to draft more binding language about how companies moderate their online platforms. It's considered a long shot, legally speaking, but the change could have dramatic and wide-ranging consequences for free speech and for businesses on the internet. The order could also implicate the Federal Trade Commission into investigating claims of political bias. The FTC would be tasked with investigating how neutral social media platforms are when they moderate content. That said, the FCC and the FTC are independent regulatory agencies, separate from President Trump's cabinet, leaving the enforcement up to their discretion. A Democratic FCC commissioner, Jessica Rosen-Worcel, told the Washington Post, quote, "Social media can be frustrating, but an executive order that would turn the Federal Communications Commission into the president's speech police is not the answer." According to legal and technology experts, the order is not likely to stand, as there are 25 years of judicial interpretation of the law that go against what Trump has asserted in the executive order. Ashkin Kazarian, the director of civil liberties at Tech Freedom, a libertarian technology policy think tank, told Business Insider, quote, "This is not how the Constitution works. The First Amendment protects Twitter from Trump. It does not protect Trump from Twitter." Former Vice President and current presidential candidate Joe Biden condemns the recent police killing of George Floyd in Minneapolis as yet another deadly encounter between police and an unarmed black man. He did so before a virtual talk with Pennsylvania Governor Tom Wolf before next Tuesday's 8 primaries. Lily Bolke has more on the story with this edition of 2020 Talks.
Welcome to 2020 Talks, where we track the 2020 elections in uncharted territory.
Watching his life be taken in the same manner, echoing nearly the same words of Eric Garner more than 5 years ago, I can't breathe. is a tragic reminder that this was not an isolated incident, but a part of an ingrained systemic cycle of injustice that still exists in this country.
Former Vice President Joe Biden yesterday condemned the police killing of George Floyd in Minneapolis earlier this week, while protests continue demanding justice for Floyd's family.
And I don't think we can move forward unless we take aggressive action to rip out the insidious race-based inequalities that corrupt every part of our society.
It was yet another deadly encounter between police and an unarmed black man. This time, the four officers involved were fired, but Floyd's family, advocates, and many politicians say that's not enough. President Donald Trump called it a very sad event. He declined to say whether he thinks the officers should be charged, saying he'll get a briefing on the case today. New Jersey Senator Cory Booker emphasized it's part of a pattern. Hundreds of black men are killed by police every year.
And we need to take the concerted actions to hold people accountable. In this specific case, these officers, we just saw live on the videotape a murder.
Booker ended his presidential campaign earlier this year and endorsed Biden. The governor of Booker's neighboring state, Pennsylvania's Tom Wolf, joined Biden for a virtual discussion yesterday. Pennsylvania is one of 8 states with primaries next Tuesday and a swing state that Trump won in 2016. It will be Pennsylvania's first election without requiring an excuse to vote absentee. Paige Cognetti is the mayor of Scranton, Biden's hometown. An independent, she says, even though mail-in ballots are secure, fear is pushing the false narrative, questioning the process, and change is never easy.
Now we're getting some questions. Does my vote count? Isn't, you know, mail-in voting fraudulent? And now we're really starting to see, you know, why it's so important that we get the education out to voters now as we approach the general election in November.
Yesterday, after Twitter for the first time tagged a couple of the president's anti-mail-in tweets as misinformation, Trump threatened to either heavily regulate or even take down social media platforms. In the past, he said Republicans wouldn't be able to win if vote-by-mail was the standard, despite studies showing it benefits neither party. While the aim is to stop misinformation, Professor Daniel Kreese of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, says he's not sure that big tech companies themselves should have that much control.
Do we really want to give very powerful and accountable companies even more power to decide what's true and what's false? I don't think that's the best solution either.
Kreese says Twitter's outright ban last year of what they determined to be political ads has lots of unintended consequences, mostly negative.
Donald Trump never needs to pay for an ad on Twitter because he has millions and millions of followers, and that will reward anything that he posts organically. Meanwhile, if you're Joe Biden and you wanted to reach the same people on Twitter, like, there's just no feasible way that you'd be able to do it.
From Pacifica Network and Public News Service, I'm Lily Bolke. Thanks for listening at pacificanetwork.org and publicnewsservice.org.
China's parliament, the National People's Congress, approved a resolution today to introduce new security legislation in Hong Kong. Beijing ordered that a new law be written that will ban secession, subversion of state power, terrorism, foreign intervention, and allow China's state security agencies to operate within the city. The National People's Congress Standing Committee will draft the new law, which is expected to take a couple months before it will be implemented by the Hong Kong government. Since news of the proposal last week, protesters in Hong Kong have been flooding the streets and clashing with police. Hong Kong pro-democracy lawmaker Claudia Mo said that the decision for this legislation has, quote, practically taken away our soul. Our soul we've been treasuring all these years, the rule of law, human rights, they're taking away all the core values we've come to know. After parliamentary meetings today, China's Premier Li Keqiang said the law was designed with Hong Kong's autonomy and freedoms in mind as part of the implementation of the One Country, Two Systems principle put in place in 1997. Wednesday, U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo said Hong Kong's autonomy from China has been largely diminished and that the U.S. would no longer consider the region separate from China for trade and economic purposes. It is not yet clear how this may affect the special trade and economic status between the U.S., Hong Kong, and China. You are listening to the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, May 28th, 2020. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Jeffrey Wade and Melissa Hood. The producer is Annette Newell, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Eric Tegedoff and Lily Bolke. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Althea Billings. Coming up next is KBOO News in Depth.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
Elizabeth Shogren is a reporter for Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting. CIR is a nonprofit news organization based in Emeryville, California, that has been conducting award-winning investigative journalism since 1977. Most recently, the organization has been honored as a Pulitzer Prize finalist and winner of the Hillman Prize, the Best of the West Award, and a prestigious Gracie Award. Elizabeth, thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure. Elizabeth, you co-wrote a stunning article detailing the PPE, or personal protective equipment, shortage in the United States and spotlighted how, after pressure from numerous organizations, the CDC's decision to downgrade its PPE guidelines affected healthcare workers across the nation. You reported that as of May 6th, over 31,000 healthcare workers in the United States have been infected, with over 100 deaths. Can you talk to us a little bit about what you learned while researching and writing this incredibly important piece?
Well, thank you for reading it. And what we learned is that drew us to this story is that doctors and nurses at hospitals around the country were terrified because they didn't feel safe to do their jobs. And they didn't feel safe because their hospitals were telling them that it was okay to go in and take care of COVID-positive patients who might be coughing all over them, and the doctors and nurses would just be wearing a surgical mask, this kind of thin wisp of tissue that we wear over our mouths, lots of us, when we go to the grocery store. It was the protection that doctors and nurses were getting from their hospitals as well when this disease was all around them. And the doctors and nurses happen to be, you know, really smart people who understand science. That's what they're trained in when they're in school. And so they knew that the science was saying that COVID-19 was a disease that could be spread through the air and not just when you touch something. And so they were afraid that, because they know that these masks that we wear aren't really intended as personal protective devices. They're intended to protect, a surgeon might wear it so that the person who's getting the operation wouldn't get sick, you know, not the other way around. And so they were scared, and that drew us to the story. And of course, the other thing that drew us to the story is why hospitals were doing this. And of course, there was a shortage of these things. But the other reason was that the government, the federal Centers for Disease Control, they had set guidelines, and those guidelines had told hospitals that respirators, these N95 masks we know about, were the preferable protection for doctors and nurses. But if you didn't have them, surgical masks were okay, and acceptable is the word that they used. And that was a message that the federal government sent out on March 10th. Earlier, however, the federal government had a much more protective standard, which said you had to have N95 masks or other respirators for your staff at hospitals. So they had downgraded they had downgraded those guidelines. And what Jennifer Gollin and I wanted to know is, why did they do that? What happened? What was happening behind the scenes to make the Centers for Disease Control and the CDC downgrade its policy? And so that's what we went to find out. And so we went to find out two things, actually. Why did the CDC downgrade its guidelines? And also, what was the impact of that on hospitals around the country and doctors and nurses? And so those were the two things we tried to get answers for.
Yeah, it's extremely frustrating that we have those respiratory protection standards, but then the CDC can, at an incredibly crucial moment, just roll them back. What do you think it says about the way our system is set up that the CDC decided to roll back guidelines, at least partly due to the fact that the hospitals didn't want to get fined for not having proper protection?
Well, I think that it shows that people and organizations with a lot of money have a lot of influence over our government, because we saw that the hospitals put an enormous amount of pressure on the CDC to roll back these guidelines. The hospitals also put an enormous amount of pressure on Congress when it was considering putting higher requirements for protective gear in a law. And it was, in fact, in the House version of the law, and then the hospitals, the Hospital Association put enormous amount of pressure on Congress to take it out before it was passed. And so that's clearly, it shows, I think, very clearly how much influence the hospitals have as a block, you know, as a political force, and that speaks very loudly and much more loudly than the groups, the unions, and other worker protection voices that there are that were desperately trying to prevent this from happening.
And you've talked about this a little bit, but why do you think the Trump administration has so vehemently declined to enact the Defense Production Act, which basically would require, from my understanding, businesses to make materials that are needed available, like masks and ventilators?
Well, they have used the Defense Production Act to some degree, even when it comes to surgical masks. But what they haven't done is to use it to kind of order the production of these masks at a broad scale. So it's a little more nuanced than just that they didn't use it at all. At first, they didn't use it, and there is a lot of criticism from lots of different sides that they haven't used it aggressively enough. It is a very interesting question, the why of it. I think it could reflect a little bit the philosophy of this White House, that there's this idea that the president and the federal government in general isn't really responsible for the responding to the COVID crisis. It's much more a state by state thing. You know, we saw when New York was in pandemonium and President Trump was talking about how he'd done so much for New York, as if New York was almost another country. And I think there's a different philosophy among Republicans, where it's a sense that the states are the most important political group, and that they should have a lot of autonomy and a lot of authority and responsibility to care for their citizens more than the federal government, kind of the idea of a weaker central government and a stronger state government. And I think maybe that comes into play a little bit here.
And you mentioned unions a little bit ago. Do you think it becomes impossible for unions to protect their workers in cases like these?
You know, it's so interesting. I was speaking with one expert in she's an industrial hygienist, so her expertise is basically how do you protect workers? And she was telling me that she thinks that the hospitals for sure have let their staffs down, but she feels like that the unions also have let their members down, that the union should have been organizing mass walkouts, that if the doctors and nurses had really band together and said, this is unacceptable, we need basic protection, that that voice would have been very strong. I'm not saying this is my view. This was her view. Her name is Lisa Brasseau. And she made a really interesting point, though, I think. And her point was that the Hippocratic Oath does not ask doctors and nurses to commit suicide, which is, in her view, what the doctors and nurses were being asked to do by their hospitals. And she felt like that the union should do more to stand up and protect them. I know unions have been doing some. I know they have been demanding more personal protective equipment, but I don't know if it's all that they could do. And I know that doctors and nurses feel a great deal of responsibility for all of us, right? They do a lot for us all the time, and of course they don't want their patients to be sick or to face a deadly disease like this without their care. So they want to be there for us. But you know, I was trying to imagine whether there was another time in our history when it was so dangerous to be a doctor or a nurse, and I can't think of one. And there was an expert we spoke with who her name is Peg Seminario, and she for decades was a leader in worker protections at the AFL-CIO at the big union, and she's so thoughtful. And one of the things that she said is through the decades that she represented workers, she never saw a time when worker protection was worse than it is right now, and she never saw a time when the federal government let down workers so much as they are right now. And I thought that was kind of stunning, you know, 40 years of this is what her expertise is. She's done that for 40 years, and she's never seen a time this bleak in any profession.
Yeah, and we're seeing that in unions and workers across the country in all fields.
It's true, and it's not just doctors and nurses who are facing risks without personal protective gear that they would need to be safe.
Well,
I wanted to say something about the statistics, because I fear it's very easy when you put a number out there for that number to start to become very important, and there are caveats with that number. So we were able to get to obtain these numbers that are it's data provided to the CDC, and so this data is accurate that there were 31,000 healthcare workers who had been infected with COVID-19. But the important thing to know is that most of the data that comes to CDC doesn't indicate whether or not the COVID positive person is a healthcare worker or not. That only 1/6 of the data at one point when CDC did an analysis had that indication. So that number is dramatically underestimates the real number of healthcare workers who have COVID-19. So it was just 1/6 of the data that included whether or not somebody was a healthcare worker. So I can't tell you that what is the real number, but I know that 31,000 vastly underestimates it.
Wow. Are there any other closing thoughts you'd like to share with our listeners today?
I guess maybe my thought would be that one of the things that we found in our research is that it seemed to us and to the experts we talked to that the CDC guidance, when it diluted or watered down its guidance, that it was being swayed by the shortages and not by science. And I think that it's one thing that I've seen happen a lot in the federal government, that agencies that are supposed to be upholding science and telling us what is the best science, what does science tell us, instead make these big compromises and tell us what does industry want us to say. And so economics play a big role, where science should be playing a bigger role. And I don't think I articulated that very well, but I just think that that's a really big question for us as a society, is how do we want to be guided by science, and in this case about the science about how much protection workers, what kind of gear is necessary to protect doctors and nurses, or do we want to be guided by economics, in this case the shortages that there are of N95s and other respirators. I think it's a big question, and since it's our government, it's our choice.
Elizabeth, thank you so much for speaking with us today.
Thanks for being interested. I appreciate it.
Elizabeth Shogren is a reporter for Reveal covering science. She tracks the real-life effects of the anti-science mentality that has seeped into many corners of the federal government. You can read more at revealnews.org. Reporting for KBOO News in Depth, I'm Nat Moon.
The COVID-19 pandemic has affected us all, our own physical and mental health, our finances, our work and social life, and the well-being of our friends and family. But no group has been more susceptible to the virus than our senior citizens. The majority of Oregon's coronavirus deaths have occurred in nursing and assisted living homes. Just last week, a nursing home in Southeast Portland was shut down by Oregon's Department of Human Services after 28 people died from COVID-19 and 117 among staff and residents tested positive. To find out more about how the virus is targeting older Oregonians and what we can do to help protect them, we're joined now by Ruby Houghton-Pitts, AARP's Oregon State Director. Ruby, thanks so much for zooming in today.
Thank you so much for including AARP in this story.
Oh, well, it's very important. In fact, my dad is actually, he's 93 years old. He's in an assisted living home. So this is very personal for me, too, what we'll be talking about today. Ruby, first, could you give us a little background on AARP Oregon and especially your role as director?
Certainly. AARP Oregon is a part of the national organization. 50 states and all the territories participate. We have employees all over the country and in the territories. And what we do is a combination of advocacy and outreach to help our members. In the state of Oregon, we have 500,000 members, a little over 500,000. And throughout the United States and in the territories collectively, we have 38 million members. These are people who are 50 plus, and many of them are like you, Ken, who have, you know, parents, and like me, that have parents and kids on both sides, maybe even grandkids. And so AARP is fast becoming the premier organization for people 50 plus and their families, because you cannot take that 50 without actually being much more inclusive of the family in its entirety.
And I mentioned in the intro, Ruby, the alarming stats about COVID-19 cases in Oregon and the impact on our seniors, your demographic really in AARP. Why are they most affected by the virus?
Well, I think that we can start with people who have comorbidities. So I think we may have heard on the news or from Dr. Fossey or from anyone from the CDC that people who have pre-existing conditions are more susceptible to this COVID virus. We're also learning that people who have been in environments where the COVID virus lives, like our long-term care facilities or our congregate care facilities throughout the state, are more susceptible because they're coming in contact with the virus.
Now, you wrote a recent article, which is available on the AARP Oregon website. It's titled, More Action Needed on Oregon's Nursing Home Crisis. First, what are nursing homes currently doing to protect their residents? And then I'll ask you what they should be doing and they're not currently, because obviously there's some failures.
Yeah. I think that the one thing that I can say that many of your listeners may have an appreciation for is that all of us have been asked to wash our hands, to cover our nose and mouth when we cough, to use hand sanitizer. Those things are a given across the board because now everyone's being asked. We need masks. We need protective equipment. And I think what we need to think about is that this gets amplified when we are in a nursing home or a congregate care facility and caring for other people. So just amplify what it is you're doing at home, or should be doing at home for that matter, and just amplify it 10 times over for what needs to take place in a facility. And so I think that it's critically important that all of the things that we do to protect ourselves 10 times over get done to protect people who are already vulnerable living in nursing homes, assisted living, long-term care facilities, etc. Because those are the places where people are sitting ducks for disease and infection. Always. It's always been like that.
In your article, you include a link to a petition which calls on the state and Governor Kate Brown to do more to protect older residents of these long-term care facilities. What's in that petition and how can listeners sign it if they'd like?
Yeah. Anyone who's interested in sending a letter off to our leaders and particularly our governor, Kate Brown, can go to www.aarp.org/OR and grab that, hit that link, and put your own personal information in and tell your own story. It's very important that our leaders hear from every person who cares about this issue. And I've been told by my staff that a lot of people have responded because people are really concerned about this issue. And we want our governor to know that. The most important things that we care about as human beings are family. And that's our family living in those congregate care facilities.
And that's what I want to get to next. It's a really a nice list in the article that you wrote about six questions that all of us can ask if we have loved ones in a nursing home or assisted living residence. I'd like to go over them one by one just to give the listeners some details here and maybe get your take on them and why they're so important. First question, has anyone in the nursing home tested positive for COVID-19?
You want to ask that question. I was just on a call that actually jarred me. That's why I'm a little stunned already, where I was talking with someone who is trying to help someone in the facility. And what this individual learned was that one of the staff people has COVID-19, but can't afford to take time off to get well. And so if you think about it, that individual is going from person to person in a nursing home environment and sharing that disease. That's frightening to me. It absolutely jarred me. It scared me.
And they may be asymptomatic or never develop any symptoms, but they're working with people who are extremely susceptible to catching the virus.
Yeah. And so that's why you want to ask that question. Has anybody been diagnosed? Could have been another resident, could have been a staff person, but ask the question. You have a right to know. Ask a question. They can't give you the name of the person, but they can certainly say yes, and they can tell you how they dealt with it.
Now, the next two I'll kind of ask together. Number two was, what's the nursing home doing to prevent infections? And then number three, the question I asked was, what does the staff need to stay safe? What equipment, personal protective equipment, PPE like masks and gloves? So really those go hand in hand.
Right. So you want to ask whether they have, and we've all become very familiar with PPE. You want to ask what kind of personal protective equipment they have. Do they have the N95 mask? Do they have gloves? Do they have the clothing that they need to wear? And does staff change that clothing when they go, and mask and so forth, when they go from one area to another, if they are treating COVID patients in that environment? Hand sanitizer should be everywhere. You should be able to ask, can I see? Can you show me via Zoom or FaceTime or something? What do you have in that facility? I think it's always nice to ask a question. They can tell you, I can't show you right now, or yes, I can show you, but I have a very close friend that's in a assisted living facility. And thank God she can tell me what's there. And she can actually show me because we can FaceTime. I can see her, and that's important.
The next two questions, so 4 and 5 in your article, I'll also put together. The first is, what's the nursing home doing to help residents stay connected with their families? And I think another question, the next one goes hand in hand with that also, is what's the residents doing to communicate important information with both the people living there and their families?
Right. So about a month ago or more, we were all told that we could no longer visit our loved ones in these facilities.
Yes, I can't visit my father. It's one of those things where we're talking on the cell phone and I'm waving through the window.
Right. And so when we family members can't be the eyes and ears for our loved ones, we need to be able to talk to them so that they can articulate what's happening. You know, did you get your meals on time today? Do you feel safe? How are people treating you? All of those sorts of things. And then as far as the level of visitation, you can talk to your father on his cell phone. There are residents in many of these homes who don't have cell phones. And it would be negligent for us to make the assumption that that level of isolation and loneliness is not affecting that person's health and well-being. And so the ability to actually FaceTime with your relative, even if the person couldn't talk, they could see you, that virtual visitation, very clear to all of us that that makes a difference. Someone that you know sees you and can actually tell you, I love you, I miss you, get well, come out. I can't wait until I can come back and see you. All of those things add to a person's well-being. And so nursing homes, we would like to see them required to provide that level of visitation where the resident may not have a telephone or may not have an iPad or any other smart device. There are ways in which the state can fund and the nursing homes can provide the ability for people to see that.
The final question of the six is the nursing home at full staffing levels for nurses and aides? And you mentioned that case where there was a staff member who had the virus but couldn't really leave for financial reasons. Wouldn't that be difficult at this point for nursing homes to have the same staffing as they did pre-pandemic?
I am sure it is, and I did mention this morning in another conversation that I had when we were talking about what can be done in that regard. So there's a public health corps in this country where I'm well aware because our daughter has a close friend who's in the public health corps, and she was deployed to Seattle when Seattle had all of its issues. And we also have the reservists that can go in and fill in. It's very important that we actually know when these facilities are understaffed, and we know the questions that we want to ask about staffing. So we don't want to ask how many people are in the nursing home. One of those people could be the cook, another could be the secretary, the staffing has to do with how many people are caring for patients. And what kind of training are they getting? Did they get a quick training course? How long have they been here? What's their experience? If someone is caring for your loved one, you want to know, what experience do they have? When you go to the doctor has a big diploma up there and you can see. When you go to a nursing home and people are rushing around, what's their experience? How many of these people are working in here, and what do they all do? Ask the questions. We have a right to know who's caring for my loved one.
I'll add a seventh question here. if a family member does ask those six questions, what do they do if they're not satisfied with the answers? Where do they turn?
We suggest that they call the state ombudsman, and you can find that on our website as well. And make sure that the state ombudsman knows what your experience was and what you were trying to get accomplished. Because I think it's very important that you have the facility name, the folks that you spoke to, and what you were trying to get accomplished. And the ombudsman can step in on your behalf and on your loved one's behalf and look into all of those things for you and with you.
Well, Ruby, thanks so much for talking with us today. I personally am very grateful for all you do and all AARP does, given my situation with my father in assisted living and our concerns and anxiety about him getting through this safely. Thank you.
Yeah. It's our pleasure, and this is what we do. And so we're here to support members 50 plus and their families, as well as the general population. So thank you so much, Kim, for interviewing me today.
We've been talking with Ruby Houghton Pitts, AARP's Oregon State Director. You could find out more about AARP and their work during the pandemic on their website, aarp.org/OR. This is Ken Jones for KBOO's News in Depth.
Special encore rebroadcast for these unique pandemic times. Dates, times, and events mentioned in the following program have already occurred and are no longer relevant.